It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Athletics Life Stories with your host, Chris Broadbent.
And there's so many more like-for-like psychological traits between entrepreneurs, successful founders, and successful sports people. When COVID came along, I ended up running the entire operation of the Premier League's COVID testing. And it was like the most awful meeting. There was like three people in the stand. It was pouring down with rain. It was freezing cold.
Welcome to Athletics Life Stories with myself, Chris Broadbent. Today I'm joined by Olympic relay medalist and former British 400 metres champion Andrew Steele. Beyond retirement, he's now an entrepreneurial innovator in fitness and an expert on personalised health solutions. Is that fair to say, Andrew?
It's good, well done, yeah. I can probably flesh that out more for you, but yes. Good work, Chris.
I've got to get it into a nutshell, I'm afraid, so hopefully that works for you. So tell us about how you got started in athletics.
Well, that's a tricky question. I think long back, most of the podcasts I've recorded in recent years have all been what I did since athletics, right? So it's refreshing to talk about the sport itself. Hey, I actually joined my coach, Steve Ball, who went on to coach me all the way through my career, more or less, when I was 8 years old. So I was with the same coach from 8 through to, I think, 30, 31 years old. I think that would probably be the best way to put it. I do actually remember my first ever 400 metres race. So I was running at Trafford Athletic Club, which went on to be my home club. I must have been 7, maybe. And at that age, you still run a 400 metres where you start on the 800 metre line and then you break after 100 metres at that age. So it's like it's a middle distance event when you're that old. And I remember there was a character who was... kept like blocking me from overtaking him, literally like running side to side and putting his arms out. So I had to like bide my time and then do a great sprint finish at the end. And I ran 72 seconds. I remember it specifically. And from that, one of the coaches from Trafford Athletic Club said, "Oh, would you like to come and train here?" So that, I guess, really, that's probably the way my athletic career started, with some help from an amazing teacher I had in primary school, a guy called Peter Felstead, who off his own back started doing extra cross-country training with us, and it was the one that sort of pushed me to try and find a club or join that club as well. So I was lucky enough, really, because I would say, Chris, and sometimes people find this quite an odd thing, is I don't see myself as that naturally talented for sport. I'm not that. I just look like an average guy. No flexibility, no strength, no speed. There's nothing particularly unique about me. Later in life, I worked in sports science and genomics, and I know there's nothing particularly unique about me as well. But I just had it seems like I have a sort of psychological resilience that allowed me to sort of work really hard and break through sort of discomfort. And thankfully, due to this teacher, he kind of saw that. And you know, when you're a child, it's often once you put your head above the waterline and someone gives you praise for something, you double down on it, right? And you do more and more of that. And I was lucky that this guy, Peter Felstead, Mr. Felstead from St. Catharines in Manchester, pushed me to do that. And thankfully, it sort of gave me the opportunity to really double down on it and eventually, you know, led me to Olympic Games, remarkably.
Yeah. You must have been pretty good, though. I mean, you won the English schools, didn't you?
Winning your schools at 16, if I'm not mistaken, in Exeter, I think. I was going to say Bury St Edmunds, and that was the one before. I did, yeah, but you know, it's funny because I was always good. You know, I was decent. I obviously had some talent, but I think my talent was less physical talent and more, you know, resilient psychological talent. So I had this sort of ability to push myself more than others, or to withstand the discomfort more than others. So naturally, I'm not saying I had, you know, no talent. Talent is a broad, complicated spectrum, but my talent led in that was sort of in the less traditional sense that I certainly was not physically sort of, you know, blessed more than any other average athlete, but psychologically I seemed to have something else about me at the time for whatever reason.
Good. Yeah. So you're about 16 at this time. So was that, would I be right now saying a bit left field this, but your dad was one of the early celebrity doctors, if you like, Dr. Christopher Steele on This Morning. Yeah. It was like him, Hilary Jones, Raj Prasad. They were like the go-to doctors on TV, weren't they?
And all sworn enemies as well. You know,
between were they?
So I think the story of that is, yeah, my dad is Dr. Chris Steele, who is still sometimes today, still on This Morning, and was the only member of the team that was there on the first episode. And still going. He's 78 now, and you know, largely retired, but he's still called upon occasionally by the show to give his opinion on something, albeit normally over a video call nowadays than in the studio. But he was on the show This Morning with Richard and Judy and all those things since 1984 maybe, or 85. So a really long television career, thankfully. So yeah, amazing really.
Did you ever join him in the studios? Did you ever get behind the scenes there?
Well, I've been on a few times. Especially around the time, which I'm sure we'll discuss more, when we were being re-awarded the medal when the Russians were disqualified. Yeah. I had a few guys on the show around there. I even went on that. You remember the weather map they used to have in the Albert Dock?
Oh, you've been on that, have you?
Been on the weather map. I've done the jump across to Ireland. Anyone that's younger listening to this won't have a clue what we're talking about. No,
can Google it. It's on YouTube. They can Google it.
For another time. But yeah, so that was it. That's what my dad did and still does to some extent today.
Good stuff. Yeah. So you're stuck with the sport, though, and I mean, did you stick with it all the way through university as well?
Well, I didn't go to university actually. So,
did you not?
I mean,
okay.
I'll try my best to remember what actually occurred. So I won the English schools in whatever year that was, maybe 2001 or something. I was 16, and I was surprised. I was surprised I won that. I shouldn't have won it. There was in fact at the time. There was an athlete you may remember, Richard Davenport, a great, amazing talent athlete, would sort of be able to win the English schools at sort of one of five different events, sort of, you know, 200, 400 hurdles, 800, 1500. And we had a great sort of rivalry at the time. And I was very surprised I came out on top that year. And that sort of gave me a sense of like, oh, actually, maybe I'm sort of, you know, like this isn't just, I'm not just sort of a good athlete regionally, maybe I've got something in it. And everyone always used to say to me, oh, would you be professional? And I always thought, no, it's not really an option for me. I didn't really feel the need to. I probably didn't have the self-belief that I was capable of being a sort of professional athlete. But then it got to when I was just turning 18, so 2003, and I'd run a bit faster. I'd run sort of, you know, into the 47s, maybe into the 46s. And I'll tell you what happened was someone said, hey, there's this race in Italy and you could run in it if you want. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And I was just I'd applied for university. I'd done my sort of UCAS stuff. And I think I had an offer accepted at Leeds to study Spanish and business, if I'm not mistaken. This was when I was 18. And then someone said, oh, you should do this race in Italy. And I went there and I ran quite fast. And it was up at this remarkable track called Sestriere, which is like 2,500 meters above altitude, and I did above sea level. And I didn't know that altitude was a performance enhancer. And I ran like really fast time. I was like amazed by it. And I thought, wow, this is great. And then they gave me some money for winning it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And they gave me a watch and they gave me all sorts of great things. And I was like, this is remarkable. Maybe I won't go to university yet. And so I actually deferred my university place. And I if I summarise that, I deferred a place at university for the next 10 years, effectively. And I kept meaning to go and never did because I kept running just that little bit faster. And then eventually things got a bit more serious. In 2006, I made the Commonwealth Games team in Melbourne. And that was an amazing experience, being at a multi-sport championship in a, you know, incredible environment, actually meeting other athletes and seeing how they trained and knowing sort of there was a somewhat, there was a life here in that, if I could, you know, just about scrape into the team each time. And that gave me sort of amazing motivation, really. Whenever I've spoken to younger athletes now that have yet to sort of reach these major championships, I find these quite sort of draconian cost-saving selection policies nowadays so short-sighted, because if I hadn't made that championship, I for sure would not have made any other championships. It gave me something extra. And I just think if you can open up the opportunity to be part of a major championship to as many people as possible, you will create a talent funnel, which is very, very effective for your federation. So you might spend more money in the early stages, but you will save yourself or create yourself more revenue in the future as a federation if you open up that opportunity to as many as possible. And I only scraped into that team. I was in the six for the relay, right? I was not, you know, guaranteed a place. And then the next year I was British champion, and the next year I was at the Olympic Games, right? So, and it certainly wouldn't have happened if I didn't make it to Melbourne.
Yeah, tell us about that British championship. So you were, I guess Rooney was the new kid in the block, really, wasn't he, for 400 metres, but you got the better of him that year, didn't you?
I did that year, but that was the only time. So, yeah,
still, right?
Yeah. Thankfully, it was in front of a home crowd in Manchester, right? So that was really good. I think I just lucky enough to be a little bit faster on the day, high 45s, if I'm not mistaken, and it was a good race. But we're good friends, and Rooney by far the more talented athlete of the two. But I'm so pleased I managed to sort of gain a national title once. It was a real, I would say, the most nerve-wracking race I've ever done was that national final, because I thought I should win and I was capable of winning, and it was, you know, local to me, and it was the home crowd, if you will. Not that there's a huge crowd at the Manchester Stadium there, but it was really that felt like the highest pressure environment, because it was mine to lose. And that's often the thing people think about. It's like, actually, when you're the favourite, or you think you can win, that's where it's you see how you handle nerves. It's not when you're the, hey, maybe I've got a chance at a win, but it'll be an outside chance. That's scary, but it's nowhere near the same as being sort of like, it's yours to lose. Like so when you see these great champions that win and win again, I have so much admiration for them, because that's a really hard thing to get right, handling the pressure of, it's all down to you. So if you don't win, it's because you messed up, as opposed to someone else was faster, right? So it's that was good. But I'm so glad I won that championship. I often forget I did, to be honest. And I've not got the video. I've not got any proof of this all messed around. That's probably one of my career highlights, for sure.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got to the World Champs that year, and you're a consistent 45 runner then now. Do you have any memories of that Osaka World Championships? I guess that was some of the biggest crowds you ran in front of at that time.
Yeah, it was. I remember it was a very intimidating environment in the stadium, because it was kind of it was super humid. And of course, in these major championships, especially when they're sort of, you know, in the Far East or you know, not in European time zones, you have these kind of heats super early in the morning, right? So the heat was at like 8:30 in the morning or something crazy local time, so you have to get your body clock sort of adjusted to that, and then your semi-finals at 10 p.m. at night the next day, so you have a real tough time. if I'm not mistaken, I don't think I made it through the heats there. Some of the memories I have from that was my first real experience of a call room. And people outside of the sport don't realise this, that, you know, just before you compete, you effectively get funneled into these small pens to sit thigh to thigh, literally like touching thighs with your competitors. And it's a real interesting microcosm of how people handle pressure, because there was someone that was really fat, maybe Ladji Decore, was he a French 400 metre runner?
He was an hurdler, wasn't he? Yeah.
No, not Decore. Yeah. There was a French 400 metre runner who was really fast, 44 guy in my heat. Okay. And then there was an Austrian runner who was at the same stage as me, first time in a major championship. And the Austrian runner was being so like superficially like nervous, as in telling me, oh my God, I'm really scared. Like, how do you feel about it? And then obviously everyone else had been super cool. And I was somewhere in the middle trying to pretend that I wasn't bothered, but I really was. They used to do this thing, and they still do it most major championships, is just before they call on your marks, they do this kind of foghorn to clear the track, you know? And I remember thinking it was like War of the Worlds. It was like this sort of really intimidating, nasty sound just before you ran. I remember thinking, wow, this is really visceral. This is a really intense experience doing this. And I was out in lane 9, I think, so I had no clue what was going on. But it was a learning experience all the same. And like I said before, like, you do not experience that. There is no replication at lower tier events. That the call room is an hour before your race, so you have to warm up 2 hours before and then effectively cool down again and do the cool down and all those nerves in and amongst all your competitors, which you never have to do at a domestic event or a smaller race. And so there's so much learning that comes from being just not required to win a medal at a championship that is so beneficial for the future. And that's why, you know, as I said, I just find it so short-sighted when federations cost save by not shipping athletes out to a major championship. And they harm themselves so much. Whereas in other sort of domestic leagues, like, you know, the US collegiate system is almost as high pressure as running, probably more so than a World or Olympic Games. And so they come to these major championships having been exposed to this. You can't build that resilience unless you've been exposed to it elsewhere. And that was it's a real learning experience. And again, like, it all contributes to something. So the next year when I went to Beijing, I knew what to expect. Just as Melbourne gave me an exposure, which I knew what to expect at a World Championship. Yeah. The World Champs helped me, you know, go one up to that, Olympic level. And I always remember Marlon Devenish telling me a story once, saying, like, the difference between the World Champs and Olympics is the World Champs, you turn out for your heat at 8 a.m. and there's, like, 10 people in the stadium. You go to the Olympics at 8 a.m. and there's 80,000 people all there, you know, like, ready to watch you, even though it's, like, the first round, super early morning there. And so, like, you were able to sort of quantify what you might need to expect in the next year. It was really, really useful. I loved Osaka. Had a great time. We were in these tiny little hotel rooms, cramped, you know, but I got to experience sort of, you know, what it's like having an accreditation in a city when there's a big event going on, and had a great time. It was also interesting because we had, I think we had the same holding camp location in Macau that we then had for Beijing. So that also made Beijing like a little bit less mysterious as well, right? So it was really good. But we didn't do that well as a team, I don't think, in 2007.
I think Christina Hergu and Nicholas Sanders kind of saved the day, didn't they?
Yeah, they saved the day.
But you got to the Olympics next year. Tell us what the feeling's like when you first get that. You confirm your Olympic place, you got selection, you got the kit. What's the reaction of your friends and family to that? You're officially an Olympian.
Yeah, that's amazing, actually. I've never really
seen it. Because that's a permanent lifetime status, though, isn't it?
That's what I mean. Once you could have been world champion, world record holder, and if you didn't make the games for whatever reason, like somehow to the everyday populace, that they can't really quantify that you're a really good athlete. You know, like the Olympics is a really... a real game changer, just in the way you define yourself externally, really, to people when you meet them. Because even if you just made the Olympic team and you absolutely failed and bombed out or got injured, the fact that you were an Olympian is this sort of mark on your CV that you're able to just take with you for the rest of your life. I'd probably say I've been quite good at capitalizing on that, but especially for most of my career, I didn't have any medal from the games either. So just having been part of it. And then, you know, the like we said, sort of the Commonwealth Games to World Championships, that World Championships to the Olympics is this level up where suddenly it's a true multi-sport. The entire world is sort of focused on this thing at any one time. And you turn up there and there's members of the royal family around, and there's, you know, there's just such a level of a different level, like commercially, all these brands that are associated with the games, and the Olympic Village was quite, you know, it was a remarkable experience the first time you arrive in there. You're just like, I always said that everybody in that village is kind of like the superlative of who they are. So they're either like the smallest or the tallest or the biggest or the, you know, they're just, it's a remarkable thing. And it's almost like some sort of bizarre, like utopian society, because everybody eats in the same place for free and then has the same level of accommodation and then gathers there. So I remember seeing, like, I think it was Rafael Nadal. It was one of the big three tennis players waiting in line for his like breakfast cereal behind like a bunch of Taiwanese like table tennis players or gymnasts or something, and thinking like, you know, this man is worth tens of millions of dollars, and these people that definitely aren't, and he's having to wait behind them. And I just thought it was brilliant, you know. The only caveat being that the NBA players, of course, were on some cruise ship somewhere or something, or stay somewhere else. But it's a really great experience, and you see all these different people and experience all these different types of humanity and social upbringings and demographics. And even within the GB team, you've got people from, you know, public school and people from, you know, really rough end of the state schools, and the difference in sports and how they treat their performance and otherwise. It's absolutely fascinating. My one downside from the games is that I was always in the 4x4 relay, which is always the last event. And so you don't get to sort of take full advantage of the social side of being at the games. You know, so the swimmers finish in the first week, and then they basically have the best school holiday of their lives, where you roam around the city with your accreditation, go to various hospitality suites of sponsors and commercial partners of the games, eat what you want at the free McDonald's in the village, and you have a great time. By the time I was ready for that, the village was shutting down, you know. So that's the one downside from being in the 400.
Yeah, you did actually perform very well, didn't you? I mean, you performed very well. You ran your fastest time there.
Yeah.
Almost at the wrong time, didn't you? I mean, you ran an absolute storm in the heats. Do you PB there?
Yeah.
You're only sub 45.
I ran my only sub 45 clocking by far my best performance in the heats, and it felt like the easiest race of my life, you know. To be honest, I probably, you know, I couldn't have run any slower to make the semi final, and I probably couldn't have run any faster than semi-final, because actually that performance took it out of me more than I was capable of running. So that really I was hitting sort of the top end of what I was actually capable of, I think. And I probably could have executed slightly better in the semi-final, maybe run, you know, a couple of tenths faster, but I realistically, I could not have made the final. Even if I'd run, I think I had to run 44.5 or 6 to have made the final. I don't think I was capable of that. If I look back on it philosophically, at the time I had all the bravado that I should have done, right? But looking back on it now, I don't think I was capable of running much faster than that. So, and that comes down to the hardest thing there was managing those times in the day. So I was getting up at 4 a.m. every day in order to have my circadian rhythms, my hormonal sort of awakeness ready for the heat, which was super early in the morning. But then my semi-finals at 10 p.m. So I was basically ready for sleep by the time my semi-final came the next day. So it's a very, very hard balance. And I think athletes, like, they don't plan for that. They don't plan for, like, how they're going to compete at 8 a.m. in the morning, how they're going to compete at 10 p.m. at night, how they're going to do that back to back. And if I was a coach, I would try and sort of replicate that in some way in training in the months running up to a major championship, because you never have to deal with that elsewhere. You know, it's a unique thing to a championship as well.
Yeah. And the other thing that Beijing was that you did actually come away eventually, years and years later, with a medal, because you finished fourth in the relays behind the cheating Russians.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, so, yeah, it was funny. We finished fourth. We ran
great. At the time, did you spoke to a lot of athletes, and they say that they knew who was at it. You know, they knew they were at it. I mean, did you know at the time that there was some dodgy stuff going on?
I think it's easy looking back at it now to say, yeah, we definitely knew, but we definitely had the conversation, right? I remember myself and Martin Rooney talking about it at the time. And I'll tell you why. There's red flags, right? So the Russians had kept their fastest athlete, who was astonishingly fast, I think ran one of the fastest splits of the games, maybe the fastest split of the games, out of the individual event and reserved them for the relay. So, like, that's a red flag. Right? You know, you, someone who's clearly your best athlete is not going under the heavier scrutiny of potential, like, post-competition testing by only being in the relay. I don't know what the calculations from the Russian side were and whether that did reduce the risk of them testing positive or not. But that was a red flag. And then the level of performance by that individual was like crazy. And then there's also almost just like, you know, there's a statistical nature of running and what's capable and what's possible and what normally gets you there. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, we ran the fastest at the time, the fastest time to ever not win a medal in before F1. Statisticians will probably correct me on that, but it was definitely up there. We ran pretty quick for not winning a medal. And if you'd said to us before the race, hey, you're going to run 2:58 and you're not going to win a medal, we would have said, oh, of course we'll win a medal with 2:58, right, based off the standard out there. So look, we ran pretty well. I actually got an inguinal, a groin hernia during my legs on the first leg in the final. On the back straight, I remember chasing LeSean Merritt and then feeling like something going in my groin, but it's an Olympic final. You can't, in a relay on first leg, you can't really, oh, just pull up. I'll be cautious. You have to just go for it. And I remember seeing on the video, I can almost identify when my stride had to change. So it definitely harmed the performance a little bit, but I still run a reasonable first leg split, if I'm not mistaken. But we finished fourth, and it was kind of like, you know, it was definitely deflating. I think at the time I probably was less deflated than I realized I would be later in life by it, because I thought, well, you know, it's okay, my first Olympic Games, I'm going to win loads more medals, we're going to run much faster. And I never did. I never ran faster. I barely made the team subsequently after that. And so, you know, it was only once sort of the next 4 years had passed and I didn't make it to London, I didn't make it onto the team for 2012, that really that fourth place felt like a real deflation, like, and a real sort of, oh, I'm unlucky I didn't make third there. But all along those years, there kept on being sort of these murmurs of like, oh yeah, you know, the Russians were cheating. The statute of limitation is 8 years, so there's still a chance, and there's still a chance. And it did hang over us. So we obviously had enough red flags that we felt there was a suspicion on that. And 9 years later, that did come to fruition amazingly. Yeah. So I've had the best of both worlds in some way. I always think of this in my post-track career. I'm almost thankful I didn't win the medal at the time. And indulge me 2 minutes on explaining this theory.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, the success in sport is in some ways almost imprisons you in a way, right? Because, you know, you are forced to pursue this, but you are obliged to by your talent, right? So if you're pretty good at this and you can make a living, like, it's crazy of you to think of a plan B, right? You absolutely mustn't think of a plan B, and you must pursue that. And certainly everybody watching sport or fans of sport or anyone around you would say, of course, like, look at you, you're good enough to be in the Olympic team, like, you must go for this. And so when you keep sort of scraping a living out of this, which I did, some years I had a good year, you know, financially, and it seemed like it was equivalent to actually having a job. But I didn't go to university. I pursued this outside of going to university. I actually, you know, eschewed going for getting any qualifications. I never had a job. I was just a runner. And so I had no work experience and no education. And then if I had won this medal in Beijing, I think I probably would have had a little bit, I would not have got dropped from the funding. So I ended up being dropped from funding a year or two later. I think I probably could have made the individual event at 2012. And then I would have kept going for four more years through to 2016 as a result of that. And I don't think the best I ever could have hoped for would be potentially maybe winning an individual medal at the Europeans, maybe. I think that's the best I could have achieved in my career.
Okay.
Maybe gold in a low year, but probably silver at Europeans. That probably would have been my ceiling. Yeah. And that would have tracked me through to being 31, 32. And I would then have sort of probably found myself a little bit blinkered as to what my possibilities were outside of sport when the end inevitably came. This way, I was forced to think and open my mind to something else because I had no two ways about it. At the point when I failed to qualify for London 2012, I hadn't been funded for 2 years. So I'd actually incurred over £20,000 of credit card debt pursuing this dream, being in London 2012. I had no education and I had no work experience. So when I failed to make the team, and I remember I actually had a sponsorship deal with a company, and I had the deal where I would effectively have been given £20,000 if I made the team, and I didn't make the team, and that would have paid my credit card debt. Right? Yeah. But I didn't make it. And so I suddenly found myself with thinking, what on earth am I going to do? Like, and I was forced to open my mind to anything. And one opportunity came, which ended up becoming DNA Fit, which is the first business that I co-founded. And I think if I had been, you know, had I made London 2012, I would not have pursued that opportunity if it had come. I would have scraped a living more over the next 4 years. And then I would have found myself in probably just as bad a position, but with 4 years less of a head start on reinventing myself or doing something else in my life. So it's a poison. What's the phrase? Poison chalice. It's a poison chalice. Yeah. It's a case of there's nothing wrong with it, and you absolutely should take advantage of your talent. But I'm almost thankful I didn't win the medal at the time, because it forced me into being open minded about what I do next. And then later on, I got the medal anyway. So you know.
On the same day then. Yeah, good. How did you cope with the next few years? Because there's no doubt you didn't really build upon 2008. You didn't kick on like you wanted to. Was it injury, illness? I mean, and what made you stubbornly fight on for a few years, really?
Well, it was never that clear that I was getting worse. You know, when it's really clear that you're like, I'm just not good anymore, then you can sort of make a decision on that. But I was still running okay, and I had various caveats as to why that was the case, right? So 2009, I remember early in 2009, I was in astonishing shape. I was out in Australia. I used to go and train at the Australian Institute of Sport with them, which called Tudor Bidder, every spring, or every Northern Hemisphere spring, autumn for them. And that was great there. And I remember running some incredible times in training, and I thought, maybe I could run, maybe I could even challenge for the British record this year. You know, I was quite bullish about my opportunities in 2009. And then I got this quite serious sort of groin injury. I can't remember what its name was now, but effectively almost like a stress fracture of the pubic symphysis. And for right or wrong, you know, the advice I was given by the medical team was, you know, if you want to have a career next year, you probably need to not run at all this year. And I think I probably could have missioned through, and just looking back at it, if I'd just gone out and dropped one really fast time and then taken the hit on the year after, then I would have been better off. But I didn't compete much in 2009 as a result, and really I never quite recovered from that. In 2010, I got glandular fever, so you know, quite common amongst athletes. It's kind of an overtraining, stress related illness, and that made me very inconsistent on my ability to train hard or compete. And I still ran 45 seconds every year of my career, I think, more or less, and did okay. That's the problem. It was never clear that I was that much slower. It always seemed like I still had it. But I was just never consistent enough. And I didn't quite execute at the right times of the year to make the team, more or less. And I scraped onto a couple of other sort of European Cups and so on, but I never made a major championship again. And 2012 came, and that the listeners, you know, your listeners will know this, but it was so all encompassing that, you know, ever since we were awarded the games in 2005 or whenever it was, every waking breath, if you told someone you were a runner, they was like, are you going to be at 2012? Are you going to be at 2012? Yeah. Every single interaction with anybody was about the fact, are you going to be at 2012? And you don't know until 3 weeks before the thing. So your entire life, your entire personality, your identity, everybody you know, the network of your friends and family are all completely defined by a home Olympic Games when it happens, if you've got a chance of being there. So it was very all-encompassing, like this mysterious beast, just like that had infiltrated everything in your life. And I quite liked that. It was great. It just made it such a big thing to work towards. But then I missed out on the team effectively by one place. You know, I was probably seventh in the country and they took the top six. Not as simple as that, but I just missed out on the team. And I can't sort of exaggerate just how that was almost like a death of a close family member to me. It was really huge. I really didn't know what to do with myself, what to call myself, how to get over that grief. It was true grief. And you know, athletes aren't ready for that. They don't expect that. But it was a home Olympic Games. I was capable of being there. And not only did I not make, you know, the final in the individual event, or not run 44.5 seconds or whatever I'd hoped to run, I didn't even make the team. And it was like, I couldn't figure out how to even come to terms with that. It was really hard. It took me many, many months to get over that.
Yeah, athletes I speak to, it's one extreme or t'other. It's a fantastic experience, or the worst experience of their life. It's very, you know, for the rest of the country, partying, it makes it almost even worse. You know, the rest of the country is loving what's going on. How did you spend it?
You know what happened is I remember on the day of Super Saturday, it was a perfect simile for me missing out on the games. I was competing at some race in a suburb of Gothenburg, Mullendal or something, and it was like the most awful meeting. There was like three people in the stand. It was pouring down with rain. It was freezing cold, and I ran awful. Like I ran really slow. I didn't even win that race. And I remember thinking, wow, this is a real representation of me not making the London.
So you were doing shitty Saturday at the same time as Super Saturday.
Yeah, exactly. And then I competed during the day. I got back, and I remember I was in a pick and mix shop in Gothenburg, like drowning my sorrows in a big bag of sweets. And my friend Rick Yates, who was also there, who's also a great athlete, yeah. Richard Yates, was like, oh, I think Greg's about to win the gold. And I was like, what? Because me and Greg Rutherford were great friends by that point, right? And best friends. And I was like, what? And I was trying to keep up with it on Twitter, which is, you know, still. And it was like data roaming. I didn't have much data and all this stuff. Trying to find Wi-Fi. And then suddenly it was a very positive thing. But it was, because suddenly my best friend had won Olympic gold. It was just unthinkable. And I couldn't believe it. It was a remarkable turn of events. So that was it. I had this sort of true epitome of me not making it on my personal level. But thankfully, I was able to still sort of celebrate that from a friend's success. So I did sort of enjoy that as a fan, if you will. But my own career never recovered from missing out in 2012 for sure.
Okay. I assume you're still quite pally with Greg then, yeah?
Yeah, very, very much so. You know, Greg was the best man at my wedding and godfather to my first child, etc. So yeah, we're very close. We work together as well there still, you know. So yeah.
Good stuff. So tell me about Outside Athletics, and you moved on to start DNA Fit at first, wasn't it? It's about, well, you talk through the science of it, but it's about the genetics and how that, well, you talk about it. You'll explain this whatever I can.
So while I was, you know, just sort of limping along, like still training a bit after 2012, I got introduced to a scientist who was looking at the role of genetics in sports people. So whether some people, you know, have certain hereditary factors in the DNA which made them more prone to being an athlete, or made them more prone to responding to different types of exercise, you know, responding to exercise in different ways to another person. Right. And then he'd done a lot of research in nutrition, and he was interested in whether that affected sort of exercise response as well. And I found it really fascinating. And I actually took the test, and it spoke quite specifically to what I'd experienced in my life, which was, you know, one of the factors I found was that there's a gene called the ACTN3 gene that is known as kind of the Olympic gene or the sprinter gene, because you could have three variants of this gene, two copies of the C, but I won't go into the detail, but there's three variants of the gene you have. One called CC, CT or TT, basically. So two copies of the C, two copies of the T, or one of each. And anyone with the presence of at least one copy of the C allele of this gene is completely overrepresented in elite level power sport. So it plays a role where it helps a very efficient synthesis of fast twitch muscle fiber.
Okay, so you're talking sprinters, you're talking power-based athletes, weightlifters, boxers.
Power events, right? Okay. So it's extremely rare that Olympic level power athletes don't have at least one copy of the C. So rare, there was even like a case study published on a long jumper once who had made the Olympic Games but didn't have the C copy of the ACTN3 gene. It's very rare. It's only one tiny factor. Of course, it's a tiny factor, but it seems to be a strong proxy for other power ability. And I did this test, and I found out that I didn't have it. I was in this like absolute minority of elite level power athletes, but it did explain a lot about when, you know, my most effective training I found. And there would certainly be some confirmation bias. I was looking for answers here in why my career had gone downhill. But I did my best when I trained like a middle distance athlete as opposed to a sprinter. So in the 400, for those that haven't done it, people tend to come at it one of two ways. They go sort of short to long. So they're either like primarily 200 meter runners who add some speed endurance on top. That tends to be popular amongst the Americans that have sort of got a stronger sort of speed power base. But then you have this kind of old school English or European mentality, which is the long to short, where you do lots of long distance graft, middle distance runners. You're almost an 800 meter runner who just does some sprint training. And I was absolutely better suited to that long to short method, whereas other athletes at the top level weren't. And the higher up you go in the 400 meters, the less common that is. So the faster I got, the more common it was that everyone around me did it the way that was the antithesis to how I trained.
Yeah.
So of course, what happens is you get better and you think, well, in order to get even better, I probably need to do it the way everybody else does it. And actually, that was the start of the downhill route for me. When I moved to sort of this short to long approach, it wasn't that clear that it was, I stopped having my unique calling card, which was my very strong last 100 meters. And I didn't really get that much faster at my sort of acceleration in early phases of the race. So it's something you can only learn through trial and error, but almost like genetically it was able to somehow, like, you know, support that trial and error in some way, along with various other things, you know, that, around nutrition facts. Regardless, I found that experience quite interesting and positive. And I just said to this guy, I said, by the way, people like me would probably like to buy this if you could offer 1, 2, 3 features in this. And I had no experience in work. I don't know what made me think I had the goal to actually give some product suggestions to this scientist about this thing. I have no experience, I have no scientific background, no work background, right? And he was like, oh, good idea. Let me introduce you to another guy who's looking at commercializing this. And effectively, that became the founding of a company called DNA Fit. It was a consumer product that people could buy to understand how or if any genetic factors they have underlying would affect their response to exercise, nutrition, and then other sort of adjacent things, you know, chronotypes or your sleep schedule, whether you're a light or deep sleeper, that sort of stuff. And the public just really liked it. We did really well. I found myself being a tech founder without meaning to learn, you know, had to learn on the go, like what it takes to run a business or do work, you know. And this is one thing that I'm very passionate about these days, is that athletes generally have no education or ability to learn on the go what it takes to actually have a job. You know, like it's sports people in general, it's a big problem. I'm trying to work towards helping that in the future, but it was a real learning. And I found myself within 2 months sort of presenting to a Premier League football club's medical team on why it was valid, and sort of really having to learn on the go. And thankfully, that was able to sort of erase my lack of work experience, my lack of education, as we were successful. So
I guess you're saying DNA it's not the be all and end all, but it's a key component for understanding performance ultimately at all.
I wouldn't even say it's a key component. It's just a component. So as you wouldn't hinge your performance choices or your exercise choices just on any other biometric, i.e. your weight or your current heart rate or anything. But there are genetic factors which affect things the way so it's about the interaction between what you do and how you're made. And you know, we all know, if we all sort of trained a group of individual athletes or gave dietary advice to a group of individuals, people respond differently to the same input. And there are many factors which affect that. One of those is genomics. So by giving people the access to that data, we were able to help sort of create a better sort of picture of where they might try first or what they might do. So some things like, you know, the way you metabolize caffeine. Caffeine is commonly used as probably the only actually effective performance enhancing substance that you can take, whether allowed or disallowed. The evidence is really only, there's not many other substances other than caffeine that actually have true evidence that they help performance. But for some people, when you look at these studies, the average work for some people, it really doesn't seem to help performance at all. They have no ergogenic effect from that. And there is a genomic relationship with that around the gene called the CYP1A2 gene. So by knowing this stuff, you can say, well, actually, I'm a slow metabolizer of caffeine, so maybe I don't need to give myself the jittery anxiety of using caffeine pre-race or whatever. So there's just numerous little things like that, which can be quite impactful in a sort of, you know, health program or a performance program.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
How granular can you get with this? I mean, can you take someone's DNA and suggest that's the sport you should be doing that, or even that's the athletics event as specific as that you should be doing? Or is it not as granular as that?
No, everyone always wants DNA to be that. There's no evidence to say it can. So, you know, for example, I don't have that gene, which is the Olympic sprinter gene. If you'd made an assumption off that, you wouldn't have said that I'd go on to win an Olympic medal in an Olympic sprint event, right? So a power event, right? So it doesn't appear that. I mean, there's so many factors to that. You know, do you live close to a facility where you can do that? How good is the coach at that place? Do you have someone that's willing to drive you to the training three times a week? Like what you like doing, you know? I would have been better suited to being an 800 meter runner, but I didn't like doing it. So that overcame every other genetic factor or other biometric factor that might have been there. So what you can or can't be, there's no way to say that from a genetic perspective, as far as I've seen. But what it is to say, well, maybe you can make a more effective route to reaching the goal that you have with this data than without. But it gets talked about in these sort of superlative, like overused terms, probably due to pop culture, like, you know, Gattaca or Aldous Huxley and stuff. People like overstate the role of genetics almost every minute of the day, and that's what we tried to, almost like our sales strategy was to understate it, and then that ended up giving us credibility, you know. But I mean, to be clear, not involved in that world or that business anymore. We sold that business after 5 years and were joined a bigger health technology company called Prenetics, where we led the European arm of that business, and we moved into much wider sort of health technology and diagnostics, so blood testing and other health services. Notably, when COVID came along, I ended up running the entire operations of the Premier League's COVID testing program, which was a remarkable experience. And lots of war stories from that, of denying players access to a match, or you know, having to track down errant players that have gone missing and send samples on private planes to, you know, places all over the world, and test people under code name before signings were announced. It was an amazing experience. And that sort of, you know, was able to get me back into working in elite sport in some way, which I found really exciting.
Sorry, you get Premier League players tested before they would sign?
I won't give any details, but there was one big signing for a major club. I had to send a nurse to another country to get the sample. And the club gave me a code name, which happened to be the code name of a very high profile player. It was the actual name of a high profile player. And I presume they gave me that to see if it leaked that they would know it was me. But it wasn't that player at all. It was a different player, but the code name was of it. Yeah, so very interesting.
Clever
what they did there. And and it was amazing. There was a curfew in the country where we had to get it. So the nurse had to, like, go under cloak and dagger to get to the sample and get it back in the lab on this private plane. It was amazing stuff, really, at the height of COVID, when it was really, you know, really restrictive. Because, of course, football came back. It was really the first thing that happened in the world after the lockdown. Right, you know, when the Premier League came back, so we had staff on every single stadium. We built the digital product, which would check their test status before anyone could enter the stadium and or the training ground. And so we had some high profile cases where we were saying, "Well, actually, I'm sorry, this player can't play." You know, that is really interesting. Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. What do you? So tell me about Prenetics then. It's much more broad than the DNA side of things. It's covering all.
Yeah, so I mean, I've since left the business as well, but effectively, I guess you'd call it sort of a digital first health company. So we had a wider sense of almost like clinical genomics. So we, you know, we'd make products that clinical entities would use for precision medicine or precision health. You could do a test, so the test called a PGX test, which is where you look at how your genetics might interact with pharmaceutical drugs. So in some cases, people need a different dosage of a drug or may have an adverse drug reaction if they take a certain medicine that's common for that condition, if they've got a certain DNA variant. So so that sort of thing. And then you into things like cancer risk and other health predispositions as well. And then, also on the other side of just general sort of health screening or diagnostic tests, so, monitoring someone's thyroid function through a home blood test, and that sort of stuff. So it was a wider, what you'd call sort of digital health ecosystem. And eventually that business, we could run infectious disease testing. So COVID came along and that was a huge task for us to help manage COVID testing there for a number of big entities, as I said, the Premier League included. And then thankfully that helped us culminate in we actually listed the business on the NASDAQ in May 2022 and I left the business subsequently. So we had a real success story from DNA Fit becoming part of Prenetics. That was a success. And then Prenetics growing to an IPO in May. So I would call myself an exited sort of tech founder these days. And that's in my world, that's sort of like a, equivalent to Olympic medal. So,
good. Good man. Yeah. Good man. What's I'm talking about a bit of a compass out here, but what is or will be AI's role in all of this
in health tech or in sport?
Yeah, in health tech. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the health tech is or health generally.
Because what you're talking about is quite tailor-made stuff, isn't it? It's tailor-made stuff you're talking
about. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, AI, it's a bit like saying, what role will the internet play? Like, it will play a role across the entire value chain. Right? Some use cases that are worth sort of think for people to consider is like, health data is famously sort of siloed, messy, and inoperable. And that means that one hospital would store your health data in a certain platform, in a certain format, and then they would send your blood test to another lab, and then there's no consistency between that lab and the next lab. There's no consistency between like advice from one practitioner to another. Can they see your health record or not? There's very messy, untranslatable data across the spectrum of health. And that, in theory, in an ideal utopia, you would turn up and someone would be able to quickly see everything you've ever taken, been treated for, notes you've been given in a secure manner. So making sense of how all of that stuff interacts with each other is impossible on a human level. Like, it's too much for a human. AI may be the route where we can finally sort of say, because you took that supplement when you were 17 for 2 years because you had a certain condition and then you had then you did this in your lifestyle, that interaction between everything could only be made sense of by a non-human mind, if you will. So that's where I see there's very obvious use cases, like transcription of medical consultations, right? That's sort of a game changer, where you remove the admin burden from doctors when they're speaking to a patient from actually writing down the notes. If this can be accurate and pull out the key takeaways without them having to do that, the doctor can do more consults or spend more time with the patient, be a bit more present. And so there's many millions of use cases for it. But I think if we probably fast forward in 10 years time, you'll probably find something where you go, oh, actually, without AI, we were so hampered in actually making sense of people's health. And that's where I see it. But it's a much bigger question I could possibly answer on an athletics podcast.
Okay. Well, let's get back to athletics then. Let's get back to both our comfort zone. What's your relationship now like with the sport? Are you still involved in any way?
Not enough, I would say. I've got a potential new venture, which hopefully, will keep me closer to sport. So while doing all of DNA Fit, for a certain point, I was for a few years, I was also Greg Rutherford's manager. So that was great. Kept me involved in sport during, thankfully during Greg's best years, if you will. That was great. And I love that. I love being around it. I work in a couple of senses as a kind of advisor in digital sport and sports technology. I would like to be even closer in on that. One of the things when I exited Prenetics after we listed, I said to myself, I want to be closer to the sport. My biggest fear is watching the Olympic Games in 4 or 8 years time and not having any connection to it. I don't just want to be a fan, somehow having spent your life in this, you still, I could have plenty of financial or commercial success elsewhere doing something else, but it doesn't tick a box as much in my soul as being sort of close to the sport, right? So for right or wrong, it's like you've been brainwashed. It's like some sort of cult. I would assume I would eschew other success in order to have like mild success, but still being aligned to the sport. And it's funny, just this morning I was chatting to Abdul Bahari. We both done very well in our professional lives. We're both just saying the same thing. Is like, for some reason it keeps pulling you back in and you want to be involved. So that's my aim, is to hopefully still be closer. I've been working on a new business around live biometric data in sport, and I'm really quite keen to progress that, and I've got some good potential opportunities with that to get me closer to almost like the events side of the sport.
And how do you view athletics now? Let's take it as a spectator. I mean, do you still, when you're involved in the, you're on the track there, how are you in the stands now? How do you see it as a spectacle, having been involved in other sports now?
It's got a lot of work to, it's got a lot of challenges to overcome, the sport, right? And the interesting thing is, once you've taken a step back from it for a few years, I have to say, other than the very major championships, I probably didn't follow the sport for a couple of years after I retired. And then you realise how little effect or visibility society has of the sport, even when it's the World Championships. Like outside of the Olympic Games, it barely makes a ripple on the sort of general populace's radar, right? It's and when you're in it, you think it's such a huge thing. You know, oh my God, if I can make the World Championships, I'll make the European Championships. And then you realize how insignificant in the grand scheme of things the sport has. And it shouldn't be that way. You know, it's the purest expression of sport, and it makes for, even the nature of the multidiscipline sport, it actually plays quite well into the sort of the modern Gen Z way of absorbing sport, which is short clips, but then with a second screen, watch in and around big major live events. So where there's an experience, but then outside of that, there's lots of easily digestible short content. Like something like athletics makes for better short form content than a whole football match, right? On paper. So the sport really has to look at itself quickly, and I think it needs to make some big moves. I've been in and around almost like the political environment of athletics and in and out over the last few years from a federation side of things. And you see how actually I am of the opinion that some of the governance structures there are holding the sport back for sure. And I don't want to be too sort of specific, but I think, you know, I've talked about innovation to a committee of delegates, should we say, and been met with so many blank faces and shaking heads. Even the fact of like doing something better in the native app for that event, right? Yeah, you know, like even the smallest innovation is like getting shut down. And I just think the sport is almost like cutting off its nose despite its face in that case by being too traditionalist. I don't know what the solution is. I don't think it's an easy solution, but there's much cleverer people than me that definitely could provide a good solution. But it needs the buy-in from the sport political environment around to actually get that through its governance controls. And I think that's going to be the thing which holds it back from progressing.
Yeah. I'm a similar sort of generation. When you're involved in the sport, you love it. But when you do take a step out of it, you realise that, yeah, people are watching this. But I've worked at many events, Olympic Games, Commonwealth Games, and then when you do take a pause, you don't consume it yourself, and you think, wow, I was so invested in that. And you see it through other people's eyes suddenly.
Why did I think this was such a big deal, you know? And you know what the funny thing is? We get these things which paper over the cracks, right? And I think the example may have been like, when was the World Champs in Berlin? It was an amazing World Champs, right? I'm trying to remember what it was. There was incredible viewership and, you know, incredible atmosphere in the stadium. And it had like this incredible stats to support it. Wow, what a success the sport is. But then outside of that, there was like absolutely nothing. And the sign of a healthy sport economy is when, you know, outside of the big events, there is like somehow it seeps into the popular culture and it seeps into people's minds all the time, no matter what. Like, is that middle of the range Premier League player has recently, you know, done this or done this campaign? Like, that's a sign that there's a healthy ecosystem around that. And I'd love athletics to not focus as much on like, is our major flagship event got high enough viewing figures, and look at other metrics, you know, like, and that's the way it's going to have a long-term future, is like, does the domestic competition make any sense? Are people even turning up to even compete in the domestic competition? If you don't have that, you aren't going to have an elite product in the end. It takes a long-term view to get right. And with the governance procedures of being elected or being in the job for a certain period of time, a short period of time, it's very hard to take a medium or long-term view in that case.
Good, good. So how fit are you still? Do you still keep fit yourself? You've talked a lot about performance and fitness.
No, not very fit. Hey? I mean, well, as you said, I've just had a second chance. I've not done any exercise for at least 6 weeks now. but I try to run like twice a week, and I've had to train myself to be able to run slower for longer. And for a year after I retired formally, I didn't do any exercise at all or think about what I ate in any way at all. I almost needed to purge myself of the care of that. And then it is hard to find a sort of healthy relationship with exercise, because exercise served a purpose before, and your quality of your exercise defined your identity and your self-worth before. And then suddenly I go and do a park run and I finish 250th. And I think, hold on a second, like, the local shopkeeper's faster than me at 5K here.
It's a long way from Beijing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So you've got to stop judging yourself. So the way I think I managed to conquer that is by the running I do now. I found myself signing up for a couple of these sort of like trail races in the Alps. And I did one in Germany, the Zugspitze, last year, which I do the shortest possible route. So a 14K route. I can't run very far, but I loved that. I loved the experience of it. It's not about the time. I don't expect to be good at it. And it gave me something to work towards. So that's currently sort of all I do. Is I'll go to the gym sometimes. I'll go for a long run with the idea that maybe next summer I'll do a really nice race in sunny Alps and have a great adventure from it. So that's probably what I would think. I would love to think I was good enough at. I've tried. Whenever I try and consistently train, I am just not good enough anymore. It supports my theory that I was psychologically talented, but not physically talented when I was young. So yeah.
Okay. Good. Good. Oh, yeah. Well, it's good to see you've made a success beyond the sport. Anyway, how important do you think being an athlete has helped you in your work career?
I think it's made.
It's character building, isn't it? Athletics.
There's so many lessons. It's a cliche, but there is so many like for likes between being a successful founder or entrepreneur or leader and the qualities needed to be a good sports person. And in fact, one of the things I'm doing now is I'm just starting a new sort of project and entity, which is to help sports people navigate how to become entrepreneurs, you know, how to found a business. What will they need to know? What will they need to think about? What kind of people will they need to bring in? Because sports people, in my experience, are really well suited to being entrepreneurs, more so than they are suited to going into normal corporate jobs. And normally when you're a sports person, you retire, you find a graduate program or a junior job that people are able to give you because you were a sports person, and you find yourself in a sort of corporate environment learning the ropes there. But that's not where we thrive. Like with especially individual sports, you thrive in being an entrepreneur, actually being that type of sort of enigma. And there's so many more like psychological traits across between entrepreneurs, successful founders and successful sports people that I do want every sports person to consider. How might they be a business owner? How might they forge their own path this way and try to give them more help with that? So I was lucky enough that I had this opportunity that showed me the ropes in real time as I left my sporting career. But if I hadn't had that, I would have really struggled to adjust into sort of an office environment where I had political, you know, hierarchy, where I wasn't the alpha male and these sort of things. And I think I really want to call on all sports people to consider being entrepreneurs and taking risk again when they leave their sports career, because they are, in my experience, quite well suited to that. So it gives you sort of a singular identity and focus as well, which sport did before, whereas being, you know, regional sales manager at a box company or something, it's probably not going to do for you, right? So I want to keep athletes happy and satisfied by following an exciting entrepreneurial path when they finish their career.
Good stuff. Brilliant. Thanks, yeah. Andrew. It's great catching up with you today. Thanks for sparing your time and being open and talking on a breadth of subjects. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. We covered a lot. Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for listening to Athletics Life Stories with Chris Broadbent. Please tell your friends and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.